Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss oncology are Drs. Orion Howard, you heard me right, Orion Howard and Matthew Vernon of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. Dr. Howard is a board-certified medical oncologist. He received his medical degree at Cornell University Medical Center and completed a fellowship with the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Serious stuff. Dr. Vernon is board certified in radiation oncology. He received his medical degree from the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. He completed his residency at the University of Minnesota Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Howard and Vernon, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thank you.
Thanks. Delighted to be here.
Well, I'm glad about that. Okay, you won't be for long. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WMC Vox Pop, and you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. All right. So, gentlemen, what exactly do you do? Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. I'm a medical oncologist, Alan. So my job is often to greet a new patient into our center, help them understand a diagnosis that they usually come in to see me already having.
They already know it. Who tells a GP or
their general practitioner, a surgeon who might do a biopsy, like a breast cancer patient. So usually the patients know what they have, and they're coming to see me in order to give them some idea of what lies ahead, both in terms of what the treatment might look like and what the prognosis might look like. And then I tend along the way to involve a bunch of other people in the care of that patient. So maybe I'm a coordinator of care, and when chemotherapy is involved, that's the part that I organize myself.
Right.
Dr. Vernon does radiation, which is a huge aspect of a lot of patients' care. And then obviously we have surgeons and we have and many other specialties that we use in the overall care of the cancer patient.
So, and from you, Matthew Vernon?
Similarly. Generally, patients know what's going on by the time they make it into my clinic. In broad strokes, most cancers are treated with some combination of chemo, radiation, and surgery are kind of the main three tools that we have.
Now, you don't do surgery, right?
I don't do any surgery. I just give radiation therapy to appropriate patients. Not all types of cancers are treated with one modality or the other, but those that have been shown to be radiation sensitive and where it's been shown to be beneficial, I usually end up seeing those patients.
So prostate cancer, obviously we know that there's radioactive seeds or something like that that are planted, right?
Yeah, and prostate cancer, sometimes we'll put radioactive seeds right into the prostate. Sometimes we'll irradiate the prostate from the outside in. Surgery is a good option for a lot of prostate cancer patients as well.
Interesting. Are you guys ready to take some calls?
Sure.
You sure?
Let's do it.
Okay, because I'm not doing it unless you tell me to. All right. So we'll go to Linda in Cornwall, New York. All right, Linda, you're on the air. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, Alan. Hi, doctors. I have a question about intravenous vitamin C, and it's been around since the 70s. There have been some studies. Some people say that it works really well in killing cancer cells, even by itself. But lately, I've been seeing some studies about vitamin C used with certain chemotherapy drugs, like paclitaxel and carboplatin, for instance. And they actually, it actually sort of energizes the drugs, and also protects healthy tissue, which is a big part, because as you know, chemotherapy can be pretty rough, on your body. So my question to you is, what is your view on vitamin C, if you have one, and how long do you think it normally takes for something like this to be written into the protocol? I know you can't just change the protocol when it's been around, there's a reason for it and so on. But what if, you know, how long does it really take for something like that to be part of a protocol?
So Linda, I mean, I think a fantastic question, and I was telling Alan earlier, I got asked this already once this morning when I was seeing patients. Not with intravenous vitamin C, but with sort of mega dose oral, you know, vitamin C. And I think I'll do the punchline first and then some explanation. I think the punchline is we don't know. You talked about data that is out there, and there is a lot of data out there, but a lot of that data is not in what the scientific community considers sort of peer-reviewed journals studied in a rigorous scientific way. There are places like Sloan Kettering that have integrative medicine departments that are really trying to look at this question, but there are theoretical reasons why vitamin C could help that date all the way back, you know, to Linus Pauling in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And then there's theoretical reasons why vitamin C could hurt, because it's a very powerful antioxidant, and a lot of chemotherapy works by creating free radicals which damage cancer cell DNA and lead to cancer cell, you know, destruction. And so one concern is, could this actually have protective effects on the cancer cells? And then the other side is that obviously there's a tremendous push to find, you know, integrative therapies that will help people either with their treatment or get through their treatment. So I don't think most of us that are oncologists, I think, do not have problems with sort of normal dose vitamin C as a supplement, but we get a little worried about the high dose intravenous or oral vitamin C, because I don't think we know the answer to your question yet.
Matthew Vernon, you want to check in on this one?
Yeah, the same question is presented to me in a radiation context as well. And I'd echo what Orion has said. Basically, it's a little bit of an oxymoron sometimes. Patients will come in wanting to do everything they can, of course, wanting to be very healthy. And a lot of these supplemental type things, while they could very feasibly be good at preventing cancer from occurring in the first place, once you actually make it to our clinic and it's time to treat your cancer, many of these things, radiation included, just like chemotherapy, work through oxidative damage to the cancer cells. So taking antioxidants, in theory, could actually work against us.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you very much, Linda. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. All right, Jim, what do you got?
Are there chronic skin eruptions that may mimic basal cell or squamous cell carcinomas?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of things that can mimic squamous and basal cell carcinomas. Really, the only way to tell for certain is to do a biopsy. Now, again, neither of us is a dermatologist, but there are certainly some characteristics that make us more suspicious that a skin lesion would be something cancerous. But there are definitely a lot of other non-cancerous things that can mimic skin tumors.
So, Matt, what are some of the ones that we should be looking for?
Well, the biggest one that I'd be looking for is anything that's changing from what it's been, if it's changing rapidly. If it's got irregular borders, if it's bleeding. But again, just because something has one of those characteristics doesn't necessarily cause alarm. It should just be enough to get you in to see your dermatologist to see what's going on and perhaps do a biopsy.
Ryan?
I would echo that completely. Okay. I mean, there's a lot of things, psoriasis and things the like that can mimic it. But very easy for a dermatologist to sort out.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so that brings us to Peter in Port Jervis. All right, Peter in Port Jervis, go ahead.
Hi, hello.
Hello. Hello.
Howdy.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you very well. I just want to say hello.
Okay, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, what do you got? Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Peter, are you there? I think we got a problem. You're not listening on the radio, are you? See, that would be a big mistake. That's against the rules, because what happens is a seven second delay, you see. What, Peter, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, what do you want?
I have a TERP procedure just finished it, and the sample that they took from it shows 2% of cells.
Cancer
and I just want to know how important that is, or is that just a...
Okay, before you answer, doctors, what I need you to do is define what he's talking about, because most of us have never heard of this before.
Like, yeah, I think you're describing a procedure where prostate tissue is taken out in what we'd call a transurethral resection of the prostate, or TURP. Generally, those samples are taken and looked at under the microscope by a pathologist to see if any prostate cancer is identified or something precancerous. And it sounds like, from your question, that some prostate cancer tissue was discovered. Is that right?
Well, I think he's somehow disappeared from our lives.
Oh, okay. That being the case, we'd need more information, really, to say what the significance of that is. Much of the prostate cancer that we see routinely is very low risk. Is cancer that sort of just sits there and doesn't do a whole lot over the course of decades, which has actually led to some changes in the screening recommendations for prostate cancer. That's very controversial still. But of course, if they found something that looked like very high-risk prostate cancer, if your PSA is abnormal, if your physical exam is normal, a lot of these things would be a reason to have it further looked at. Whoever your urologist is who did the TURP, should be able to sit down with you and tell you a little bit more about the significance of that.
So I will very quickly ask you a question, because we only have a second before we got a break, and that is the quintessential question among many people who have, you know, are examined for prostate cancer is, and if it's affirmed, is either surgery or radiology. You're a radiologist. Do you have an answer to that?
For prostate cancer specifically? Yeah. In general, the treatment for prostate cancer is either radiation or surgery. Some patients will get a little of both. Chemotherapy doesn't typically take part in prostate cancer until it's recurred, but sometimes there are hormonal treatments that we use. But for the best we know, for most prostate cancer out there, radiation and surgery approaches are essentially identical in the likelihood that the patient will be cured. They just cause different side effects.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Cheryl R. Lindenbaum Comprehensive Cancer Center at New York Presbyterian Hudson Valley Hospital. NewYorkPresbyterian.org/Hudson Valley to learn more. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, Japanese, Chinese, and sushi bar. Dinner entrees served with soup, salad, and shrimp appetizer. Delivery expanding to Gilderland, 518-432-0358. Northeast Solar in Hatfield, Massachusetts, helping Pioneer Valley residents live more sustainably with solar power. For home, business, or farm, keep solar local, northeast-solar.com. Colby Attorney Service, document filing, document and information retrieval, and other services, including legal publishing and corporate record searches, colbyservice.com. And from Bodywork Professionals, licensed massage therapist, Latham and Saratoga, handmade 2017 letterpress gift certificates available in shop or online. Your massage and bodywork experts, bodyworkprofessionals.com.
And we are back. Thank you. Thank you. And let's go. Remember, we're talking to Drs. Orion Howard and Matthew Vernon of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. And Dr. Howard is a board-certified medical oncologist, and Dr. Vernon is board-certified in radiation oncology. Okay, so everything you wanted to know. Let's go to Lewis in Kingston. Okay, Lewis, you're on.
All right, thanks for taking the call. Radiation oncology uses, my doctor said he's got a radiation machine, and it's like a circle. It goes around shooting a beam until it, ends up focusing just on the prostate. I'm talking about my prostate cancer. So how does that differ from proton beam work on the prostate? That's one question. Second question has to do with the hormone therapy as to whether high testosterone or no testosterone is better, and does it depend on what kind of cancer you have?
Okay,
two questions.
So,
one, proton beam as opposed to radiation. Go ahead.
Okay. And Matt Vernon?
Yeah, so most of the radiation oncology clinics around that you will find generate the radiation using a machine called a linear accelerator. It produces very high energy X-rays that go through the tissue in one side and out the other, and treating everything in between. And the reason that the machine rotates around the patient like that is typically because we'll come in from a number of different angles so that we can avoid some of the normal organs in the area, prostate cancer, for example, we're constantly trying to keep the radiation off of the bladder and the rectum and other things in the pelvis. So basically, the difference between that and proton radiation is, for all intents and purposes, just that the delivery mechanism is different. Proton ions, as they enter into the body, will also pass through anything that they have to pass through to get to the prostate, but then they kind of stop on a dime, and you don't end up getting all the exit dose going out the other side. So on paper, at least, it should appear that the dose to the normal tissues is reduced, and the side effects to the patient should be more favorable. It's not that it's any more curative, but just that you can spare some of the surrounding tissues to a greater extent. Now, whether that bears out in things like prostate cancer is something radiation oncologists argue about a lot. There's definitely a lot of tumors that are more rare than that are really best treated by protons, especially a lot of pediatric tumors. And it's very expensive to create these proton centers, and so there are only 15 or 20 of these nationwide.
If you had prostate cancer, which would you do?
If I had prostate cancer, I'd be very comfortable getting my cancer treated with a linear accelerator-based treatment. If my child had a brain tumor, I would definitely be down at Memorial or Mass General or whatever.
Okay, now, my kind of cancer is, they said, so-so. It's not the slowest. It's not the fastest. It's been 2 or 3 years. I did, like, 3 months of hormone ablation,
yep.
Okay, and it dropped the numbers from 12 down to 0. But then after about 6 months or a year, that went back up to about 10. So I took one more shot of the hormone ablation, right?
Okay.
Which stops the testosterone in the body. Which does that put to sleep or does it kill the cancer?
Yeah, testosterone is a growth factor. If you want to think of it as feeding the cancer cells, or more accurately, telling them to grow and divide and proliferate and do the bad things that cancer cells do. But the ablating the testosterone or disrupting the production of testosterone in the body doesn't in and of itself kill any of the cancer cells. Your immune system has ways of killing cancer cells, and so that may be happening to some extent while they've been sort of put into this dormant state while you're getting the androgen deprivation.
Is it a good way to get your immune system to kill off the cancers while it's...
No, it's a good way to put your cancer cells to sleep while you either undergo another treatment, or some patients will do just that treatment alone, and it will sort of put their cancer to sleep for a very, very long time.
So, Dr. Vernon, can you tell us, I just need a little definition of the word ablation.
Yeah, that's, I'd use the word deprivation. A lot of times we'll talk about androgen deprivation,
right.
So testosterone's an androgen that's normally being produced in men, of course, and giving certain medications can basically block the body from producing testosterone. Other drugs that are a little less commonly used also block the action of any testosterone that does make it.
Do you have any suggestions as to what a person can do to increase their own immune system to kill off the cancer?
Again, that's a question that we really get a lot. Usually it's not anything that's anything we recommend you do once you've got a cancer diagnosis. For other cancers, certainly things like antioxidants and some of the things that are marketed over the
vitamin
counter.
Vitamin E, vitamin C.
Okay, and we're going to go to Dr. Orion Howard. Go ahead, Dr.
I was just going to say, we're talking about Provenge.
There
is one treatment out there for prostate cancer now that's revolutionary in its idea, although not heavily used, which is a vaccination for people with active prostate cancer that revs up the immune system to destroy the prostate cancer cells. Yeah. It's actually made by taking somebody's blood, sending it to the company that produces this vaccine, and about 3 months later, you have an engineered vaccine against your own cancer. It's about,
are there any names or phone numbers?
It's out there. It's FDA approved. It's called Provenge, but the dilemma with it is that it's over $100,000 for a treatment. And right now, the effectiveness of it is measured in enhancing, patient survival by weeks, not by months or years. But when we get better versions of that type of therapy, we're going to be onto something. I mean, that's
what about that?
Lewis, that's all we can give you right now because
taking the genetic code of your prostate cancer and doing something with that.
Well, that's a movement we're doing for tons of different types of cancers. I mean, that's the wave of the future of cancer treatment, which is we know the genetic code of the human body now, and we can look at a tumor and we can say this tumor has 3 mutations in it that we know are probably part of the cause of that patient's cancer. And some of those we have drugs that we've already designed directly to combat those mutations. Others are the focus of intensive research on combating those mutations, and others are to come as we figure more and more out about that.
Okay, Lewis, thank you. All right, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We're with Drs. Orion Howard and Matthew Vernon of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. All right, and now we're going to go to, Ron in Hyde Park. Ron in Hyde Park, you're on.
1-800-348.
Oh, Ron.
Hello.
Ron, you're breaking the rule. You're breaking the rule. You have to turn the radio off.
I'm in the car, so I have the Bluetooth. I turned it off.
All right, go ahead.
Quick question. I survived. I'm about 7 years. I had Hodgkin's lymphoma. I went down to Sloan. They did series of R-CHOP. I asked my oncologist, this might be a little bit off the beaten path, but I asked her if the internet is the bane of her existence or if she feels that an informed patient is a better patient. She told me it was the bane of her existence because people get on and they think if I eat, you know, horseradish with apple cider vinegar because I read it, it's going to help me, whatever. How do you guys feel about the internet?
I love the internet. I mean, I don't mind being challenged by my patients at all. And, you know, it doesn't, I mean, I would love to say that I am completely up to date. I know everything that is out there. But, you know, occasionally I'll have a patient who will see a story or read something and will discuss something with me that'll jog my head to go explore that on my own. And I would argue that there are certainly downsides to it. I mean, there are things that come out that do not apply to the patient asking the question and serve as a long distraction of our meeting. But I love the times where somebody finds something on their own, which might be my next thought for their treatment, and they bring it up themselves, and it engages them in the process.
Except that we self-diagnosticians, we people who worry about our health a lot, often we'll go, when we have anything on our bodies or in our head, or whatever, we'll go and we'll find it and say, yes, that's it, I have this terrible disease. It turns out nonsense.
Well, and that's very different. So what I'm talking about, here is somebody who's been diagnosed with, let's say, Hodgkin's disease, and has gone through treatment for the Hodgkin's and now wants to know what's next. What would, if this came back, and who has a very intimate knowledge of their disease and wants to explore that. I agree with you that the number of times I get people who come in and say, I think I have blank because I was tired and I had sweats and I was a little bit constipated last night.
Right.
And I think I have rectal cancer. That's a different problem.
It impacts on the limited time, though. I mean, let's face it, you guys don't spend that much time. I'm sure you'd both like to spend a lot more time with your patients, but because of the constraints, that there isn't that amount of time. So if a patient comes in and starts waiting, and I throw wasting, and I understand what you're saying about, you know, the tete-a-tete where you're picking up, there may be some new therapy that, you know, you're just reading in some journal, but they've really done some investigation about. But I mean, on the average, I mean, she told me, my oncologist told me that she just wished patients would have faith in what they're doing, that they've all gone to medical school, they all specialize, they have a series of pathologists, they have specialists who are doing immunotherapy and whatever. And I guess she's an older doctor, I guess, from the old school of where doctors are God, we can't challenge them. But it's just interesting to hear that you're willing to listen to the patient. But again, I just think it impacts on the amount of time.
Does your doctor's initials CP?
Yes.
She's a wonderful doctor, and she does know.
She saved my life. I mean, I have no problems. She was great. She stood with me the whole way.
One of the most foremost Hodgkin's experts in the United States, and she's a wonderful woman. And
yes, she is.
But you know, I love informed patients, and I think a patient always will be their best self-advocate.
And so when somebody comes in, like Ron, with a list, I had a very good friend, a doctor, gone now, but he used to say, beware of a patient who comes in with a list of things.
I don't mind lists. Lists are great but what I like to do with my patients, and again, this is me, I like to describe to patients what I think might lie ahead.
Right.
And I love it when they then look at their list and they say, okay, got that, got that, got that, got that, got. And then they have one or two that are left. You do have patients where you do your whole thing, and then they go down their list and they ask you all the questions that you've answered during your thing.
That's a very nerve-wracking
thing. And that's a nerve-wracking thing. Yeah, but lists are great because you can refer back to them and you can feel like you got your job done with your doctor.
Matt Vernon, do you want to add anything to this?
No, I'd echo most of that. Again, it sounds like your doctor indicated that, sure, we don't necessarily like to be second-guessed. That's not the same thing as coming in as an informed patient. The internet has a lot of great resources on it. Stay away from sites where it's clear that they're trying to sell you something. Stay away from sites where it's mostly patient forums. Those can be useful, but keep in mind that the people who get on the internet and tend to post things usually are the people who've had a bad experience and not necessarily the people who've had a typical experience. Like the Mayo Clinic site or the Cleveland Clinic site or Memorials or any of these major tertiary institutions are going to have a lot of great information on their sites.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. All right, now we're going to go. By the way, now is a very good time to make a call. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Now to Emily in Shelburne Falls. All right, Emily, you're on.
Hello, thank you very much. I am living with my husband who has cancer, diagnosed 3 years ago with colorectal cancer. And then the cancer came back to his liver, and they performed a SIRT treatment on him in June. And he had a cold recently and still sort of coughing and is saying he feels lethargic and tired and coughing and no high fever or anything like that. But I'm just wondering, I did look up on the internet yesterday on SIRT treatments and couldn't get any information on 6 months later what any responses could be or reactions. Do you have any information on this? We are going to see his doctors at Mass General this week. But I just wondered, since you're here today, whether you had any information I could bring to Mass General or just calm me down today.
Yeah, very good question. So CERT, SIRT is selective internal radiation therapy, right. In which small, basically beads, which are coated with a radioactive yttrium or another radioactive element, are injected directly into, in this case, the blood supply of usually half of the liver at a time. There are directed chemotherapy treatments that are very much like this as well. And the beauty of this is that we can put the radiation just where it's needed. All those blood vessels are going directly into the tumor tissue. They're landing there and getting stuck and basically radiating the tumor from the inside out. So we're able to give very, very high doses of radiation into just a very, very targeted spot. And so usually the side effects of that are fairly localized to just where we've given it. And the way that radiation therapy works, again, in general, now just as a disclaimer, I don't offer this treatment myself, basically. All of my patients, we're part of the Dartmouth system, so my patients who need this, it would be referred up to Dartmouth or another tertiary referral center. But in general, the effects of radiation generally have worn off, at least in the acute phase, within a couple months of having this type of procedure done. There can be scar tissue that forms in the area that can lead to some other things. But for the most part, they're going to be localized side effects. What you're describing as far as cough and I'm sorry, tell me, what are some of the other symptoms that he's experiencing?
Well, he's definitely presenting with a cold that's been dragging on for, it feels like months, but, you know, he got something mid-October, then had an endoscopy with, you know, anesthesia, and then he seemed like he was recovering from the cough and cold, and then it presented again like the middle of November, and here we are, you know, almost the second week of December, and he's still, you know, coughing and presenting like he has a cold, but feeling lethargic, and one of the things his oncologist told us was that when the liver starts to fail, you are going to start to feel more tired. And so we're both feeling a little apprehensive that even though he's presented really well with scans for two times now since he's had the CERT treatment, you know, he's we're always on edge here. You know, is the cancer, is it back? Is
okay.
it, you know?
Doc, what do you got?
Yeah, sure. It's difficult to come up with specifics because, of
right.
course, not knowing his particular case. But most
right.
of those things are things that are going to shake out in the blood work and the imaging that he's probably about to get. It doesn't sound offhand from what you've described, like lingering effects from the CERT, though.
Okay.
Well, we'll be going to Mass General this week. I just thought I'd check in with you
and,
guys. Thank you, Dr. Shartok.
Emily, good luck to you.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I'm hooked on the panel.
Okay. Well,
I just
great.
Want you to know.
Keep listening.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I do.
Okay.
Thanks.
All
Bye.
Right. And now we're going to go to Betsy. All right, Betsy on line two. Betsy, you're on.
Hello.
Hello, Betsy.
Hi. I'm very far along on the bell curve of dealing with ovarian cancer. I'm over 14 years out. I've had 7 courses of chemo. I've had 4 surgeries, including one for a brain met. And my doctor is looking at the possibility of immune RT to exploit the abscopal effect, which I understand to be you radiate one area and it actually kills more of those cells or tumors in another area of the body. And I just wondered what you can tell me about immune RT. I haven't been to the doctor to talk to him about it, but when I heard you were on the show, I thought I'd ask.
So this is Orion Howard answering. So I think, Betsy, what you're describing is an idea that's relatively recent. It's the idea that radiation will, in the process of killing cancer cells in one area, and you only have to do this to one area, so it's potentially helpful in people even when there's 20 spots you're watching, is the idea that the radiation will destroy the cancer cells, and in that process will present proteins on the surface of the cancer cells to the immune system. And your immune system will see those proteins from the destroyed cancer cells, will rev up, and will then go find those proteins on the living cancer cells and attack them. And there's been some data in some of the new immune therapies that we've heard about, like Opdivo and Keytruda, which are these immune therapies approved for melanoma and lung cancer and kidney cancer, that if you do radiation in concert with these therapies, it may help them find living cancer cells after you've given them some dead cancer cell proteins to look at. And I think that's the idea behind that radiation.
Yeah, it's a topic that's had some national press. It's a really, really super interesting principle. It's not something that we still, I would say, routinely do for the effect itself. If we're radiating something for a palliative effect or because this is the only spot that we see, we anticipate that maybe there's some benefit elsewhere in any disease that we can't see. But at this point of the game, especially in patients with metastatic disease, usually we're reserving radiation for areas that are causing symptoms.
Betsy, I'm so sorry we have to take a break. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, take it away.
Support comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, now specializing in Makoplasty partial knee surfacing as an option to total knee replacement for early to mid-stage osteoarthritis. HealthQuest.org/ortho. Brattleboro Retreat offering partial hospital and intensive outpatient care at the Birches Treatment Center. Full and half-day psychiatric and addiction treatment and on-campus housing available. BrattleboroRetreat.org/Birches. NBT Bank offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. Fort Hill Auto Body, Amherst, Massachusetts, locally owned and operated since 1997, providing auto body repair, detailing, painting, and glass replacement. A proud supporter of public radio, FortHillAutoBody.com. And from Preservation League of New York State, offering EPIP, a revolving loan program to acquire, stabilize, and restore historic buildings in New York. PreserveNYS.org.
So we're here on the Medical Monday and with Doctors Orion Howard and Matthew Vernon of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. Dr. Howard is a board-certified medical oncologist. Dr. Vernon is a board-certified in radiation oncology. And I must say, I'm really enjoying the breadth of their knowledge. It's really great to have you guys here. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. So anyway, we're going to go now to Matt in Monroe. All right, Matt in Monroe, you're on. Go.
Hello, doctors. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I have a question about CBD oil, which is, you know, Charlie Baker Delta. It's an oil, I guess, derived from the hemp plant. As regards to cancer treatment or treatment of pain or something like that, I was told about.
Yes.
That, and I wondered if you guys know anything about it, or
we know surprisingly little about it because, as maybe you're aware, most of the cannabinoids have been fairly sparsely researched. Medicinal marijuana is legal in Vermont. I'm not sure. I think it was legalized, at least in some forms, in New York within the last couple of years. But at least in Vermont, the way that we refer patients for cannabinoid therapy would be essentially just they sign up on a registry. We verify that they're a patient of ours who has cancer, and they go off and do whatever they see fit, or they're definitely very knowledgeable people in the dispensaries who help them find what they should be using to alleviate symptoms. For the most part,
yeah,
that's all
not,
it is. I'm sorry?
This is not like marijuana. It's the other form, not THC. That's something else that is contained in the marijuana plant. It's legal in all 50 states. It's not like a get you high type of drug.
Right. So, again, I know that there are products that are marketed for this. I believe in Vermont, at least, they still come through the dispensary, and patients are on the marijuana registry, even though, again, as you pointed out, it's not the THC. It's not the part of the cannabis that produces the euphoric effect. To my knowledge, again, and I say this to my knowledge because we don't tend to be part of the prescribing team. We just verify that a patient has cancer. But most of these compounds are useful in certain symptoms that can come from cancer or from cancer treatment. I'm not aware of any of them that are actually being used as a directly anti-cancer drug.
There's been I have patients asking me this now almost daily. And so something has happened in the... I don't like the term lay world, but let's call it lay world. Something's happened in the lay world in the last 3 to 4 months where my patients are routinely asking the question you're asking, Matt. And I think in the scientific world, there just is not a lot of data out here. And it falls in my mind into the heading of, you know, patients really want to grab control over a disease that is very disempowering. And it takes control away from patients.
Sure.
It takes control away from doctors. And people would love to get some of that control back. And I think a lot of this you find as a result of that desire for patients to get control back. We just have very little data.
Matt, thank you for the call. Appreciate it very much. All right. So now we'll go to Teresa in Poughkeepsie, Po-town. Okay, Teresa, you're on.
Yes. Hi. I'm wondering if you could address more of the survivorship issues and when you finish your cancer treatment, having a survivorship plan, and if your doctors don't provide one, how do you get one? For example, and I was treated by CP also, and I just found out because I had the bleomycin that I should not be exposed to large amounts of oxygen. And, you know, so how do you, in terms of the survivorship with radiation and chemotherapy side effects, and how do we go about getting that information?
So that's a really good question. And it's not only a really good question that you're asking, it's a really good question that people have been addressing wholeheartedly in the last, let's say, 5 years. We learned with the treatment of Hodgkin's, for instance, which you're describing and an earlier caller was describing, that we cure the vast majority of people with Hodgkin's disease now. And when we looked at therapies we used to do that back in the 1970s and 80s, when we were using a type of chemotherapy called MOPP, M-O-P-P, we learned that up to 20% of patients were developing leukemias you know, 20 years down the road. And we were fixing the vast majority of patients with Hodgkin's disease only to face issues 20 years down the road that were equally devastating. And experiences like that have led to a huge interest in survivorship. Our center now has a nurse practitioner, Carol, who is developing survivorship plans for every patient, and we are setting it in motion. It's a very onerous project. I mean, you're talking here about giving every patient at the end of their treatment a list of what all of their treatments were, all of the potential short-term, moderate-term, and long-term side effects, and who's the best person tasked with monitoring them as time goes forward for the development of those. And it really becomes a medical profession unto itself that we're going to take ownership of because we're the ones delivering the treatment. But that is rolling out at a huge rate. There's a group called the American College of Surgeons that accredits a large number of cancer centers in the United States that have set a goal for this year, 2016, of giving survivorship care plans to 25% of patients completing curative treatment, 50% next year, with a goal of getting that to 100% over the next decade. So this will be solved, and it's a question of what's the best way to do it. But everybody is working on this now.
And it's important for us to have, I think, as you know, former patients. And I don't regret getting the treatment, but, you know, knowing down the line what to look for, I think, has helped my health, certainly.
Thank you, Teresa.
You know, with cardiac issues, et cetera.
Thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll go. We have maybe one or two more lines open. So we'll go to Helena in West Hurley. All right. Helena, you're on.
Yes. Thank you very much, doctors. I have a follow-up question on radiation therapy. I understand the radiation targets the blood cells that feed the tumors, but what actually happens to the tumor itself? Does it disintegrate? Then does it pass through the intestine? I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's a good question. Radiation probably works in a couple of different ways. As you mentioned, it does act on the blood vessels and starves the tumor of a little bit of its blood supply. But the main way that it's acting against the cancer cells is actually directly damaging the DNA of those cancer cells. Of course, it's damaging the DNA of a lot of the surrounding normal cells as well, but those cells are better at repairing the damage, whereas the cancer cells are terrible at repairing the radiation damage. And eventually what happens is they try to divide and they undergo what's kind of a programmed cell death. They die off. The immune system tends to be what comes along and cleans up the debris that's left behind, and then gets carried off just as anything else in a healing wound or a healing infection would get carted away by the immune system and disposed of. A lot of long-term side effects, incidentally, stem from this process where scar tissue is left behind anywhere that the immune system does this cleanup. And so some of the longer-lasting effects of radiation stem from this scar tissue that's left behind after this process.
And how do you avoid the scar tissue?
We don't. I mean, they're ways that we can mitigate the dose that's given. There are certain radioprotective drugs that have been studied, but most of them haven't really panned out feasibly as a way to try to mitigate the scar tissue, because any drug we give that's protecting normal cells is also, in theory, protecting cancer cells too.
Well, Matt, yeah. All of these years, you think about it, we have advanced incredibly in modern medicine. I mean, you know, people who are diabetic died, they got blind, they died. That really doesn't happen the same way, certainly, now, because do you guys see that the things you're talking about, you know, even this last wonderful question is that, oh, you know, in 10 years, that won't be a problem anymore?
It's a possibility. Certainly, that's sort of radiation's MO, at least, though. Chemotherapy is a little different in that it doesn't leave the same degree of scar tissue behind. But your question's well taken. Cancer treatment's advancing by leaps and bounds. I think that probably what's even more important has been prevention. A lot of the early diagnosis. A lot of the real big success stories that we have not been from because our treatment is getting better by leaps and bounds.
You mean, but like smoking?
Like smoking cessation, like breast cancer screening. Lung cancer screening is on the up and coming for heavy smokers.
Cervical cancer was the number one killer of women in 1900, and now
HPV.
I see a case maybe every 10 years.
And probably less because of the HPV vaccine,
We'll see. That's coming, right? We're vaccinating teenagers, so hopefully we'll know the effect of that in 20 years.
Helena, great question. Thank you so much,
and I hope that, unfortunately, the cancer patients, their immune system is so compromised, so if there's something we can do to build up their immune system while they're getting treatment, that's the big question in the room.
Thanks, Helena.
But thank you very much.
Yeah, bye.
Thank you. Good luck.
And now on to Kate in Western Massachusetts. Okay, Kate, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was diagnosed a year ago in May with a grade 2 slow-growing renal cancer. We're not doing anything for follow-up other than CAT scans and every other year, and then X-ray and ultrasound of the kidneys on the alternate years. I'm not really worried about it because it was a slow-growing tumor, and they told me that it probably been in there for years, and they don't really do, as far as I know, they don't do any chemo or anything for that. Is that true, or radiation?
That's correct. I mean, the chance of curing an early, I take it this was removed surgically, correct?
It was removed. Yeah. He took about a tenth of my left kidney. I asked him, would he do a biopsy while he was in there? He said, no, absolutely not. He didn't even want to nick that while he was in there. And they did take that section out, and it was a grade 2.
The classic thing when you think you have a kidney tumor is not to do a biopsy because there's some worry about tracking cancer cells along the biopsy track. So they tend to go in and just remove them if they're pretty suspicious it's a cancer. And there really is, for an early stage kidney cancer, the cure rate is exceedingly high, and there's no proof that doing chemotherapy or biologic therapy or radiation afterward improves the cure
rate. Makes any difference.
Correct. There are some wonderful new drugs in the treatment of kidney cancer that is spread, which is a position you obviously never want to be in. And they're beginning to look at using some of those drugs as preventatives in the setting, you know, immediately after surgery. But that's in its infancy right now because the cure rates are so high. And when you're doing really well, your first job is not to try to cause any further harm.
Well, recently, one of my oldest friends was also, mine was an incidental finding, and they had an incidental finding with her and found a tumor and on her kidney. And they did a needle biopsy, and it unfortunately is a very highly aggressive, rare central duct kidney cancer. And they did the needle radiographically guided needle biopsy, and I was shocked because my doctor had said he didn't want to touch the tumor while it was still attached to me and while it was in there. And I didn't understand why they did that. Is there an advantage to doing that rather than just taking it out? They did remove her entire kidney, but it was 3 or 4 weeks after the needle biopsy, and now she has a tumor in her thyroid.
Well, you described something. You said it was a very interesting, strange tumor, and I'm guessing they did a biopsy because something struck them as not being right for a normal kidney tumor. And so, if you think
with a rare tumor, I mean, when you put a needle, I'm upset with it because when they put a needle in that, then it bleeds and it's releasing cells, and it's a highly aggressive cancer.
Most,
and I just was surprised they did it.
But most tumors don't do that. There's something to kidney cancer where we try to avoid sticking needles in it, but it sounds like this was something funny and different. And knowing that it was something funny and different probably influenced the way they treated her, and it sounds like that was the right thing to do.
All right.
Kate, thank you for your call. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much.
We are now out of time, and we didn't leave anybody on the line. That's extraordinary. My apologies to anybody who thought about calling but didn't. I want to thank Drs. Orion Howard and Matthew Vernon of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center for being with us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from Nathan Litauer Hospital, announcing the building of a new dialysis center in Gloversville for renal kidney care, opening this winter, nlh.org. Thanks to our wonderful engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Louise Butler for stepping in and answering the phones. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Shartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/voxpop. Stay tuned now for a news update.